Oslo is lovely this time of year. Come and join the party. As he turned, his hologram vanished, leaving me standing, once more, in the dark. I ended the orb and tapped my comms unit to see if Bug had anything at all. Chapter 110. Ui Oterra, the Blue Temple, Interrogation Room 3, Tsushima Island, Japan. Top caught up to me on the way to the interrogation rooms.
Are you going to talk with Major Mon?
He asked. Yeah, they said she's coming out of it.
Scott Wilson sent over a file.
He held out a blue file folder.
He wants you to read this before you do the interview.
What is it? There was a strange look in Top's eyes.
Seems Nikki's people did a full background check on her, a very deep dive, and we also did a physical workup. Blood, prints, everything.
Has she been compromised?
Best you read the report,
he said, gave me a strange smile and a nod and left me there. I flipped open the folder and read.
Well, damn,
I said aloud. I leaned against the wall and read it all through again.
Yo, boss,
said a voice, and I looked up to see Bunny and Andrea coming through the doorway at the opposite end of the hall. I handed them the folder, and they leaned together to read it. At first, they looked blank. Then they looked confused. Then they looked mad.
Yeah, I said. Life just keeps on getting more interesting, doesn't it?
I looked in through a small grilled window at the woman seated at the interview table, cuffed, bowed, and broken. I quietly slid the panel shut. I'll talk to her alone. Andrea punched in the lock code and held the door for me. Mun's head jerked up as I came in, and she watched me with hostile cat eyes as I walked around and sat down across from her. I said nothing for a long time, maybe 2 full minutes. She did her best to meet my eyes, but eventually her glare faltered and she turned to look at the wall. So, I said, you want to tell me who the hell you are?
Chapter 111. Ui Oterra, the Blue Temple, Interrogation Room 3, Tsushima Island, Japan.
She said nothing. I sighed, very theatrical, the kind of sigh that says, we can do this the easy way or the hard way, and you just made the wrong choice. That kind of sigh. Where is Major Mun? I asked. Nothing. How did you infiltrate Kingdom? Are there other agents in that organization? Nothing. Okay, I said. Then let me tell you. That got a flinch, but she still stared at the wall. Your name is Staff Sergeant Soon-Wei Kang. You are not a member of Kingdom. You're not even a Korean national. You're a citizen of the United States. You are separated from Mr. James Kang. You have a 7-month-old daughter but do not have custody. Everyone thinks you were on leave from Fort Story in Virginia Beach. Won't they be surprised when you don't turn up for duty on December 27th? Did you think you'd be back by then? She tried to glare through the fear, but I wasn't fooled. To anyone who doesn't know Major Mun personally, you're a good fit. Same height, about the same weight and age. Someone gave you a hell of a lot of training so you could pass muster as Special Forces. I'm impressed. Mind you, I'm pretty unhappy, but I am impressed. I let silence beat her up for a bit. Here's the thing, I said. I don't yet know if your actions were because you are under duress or because you are a spooky psycho lady. Right now I'm leaning more toward the latter because after evaluating your actions last night, you clearly tried to thwart our mission. Notice that I said thwart. I don't often use that word with a straight face, but I am not laughing right now. This is my serious face. This, in point of fact, is my really unhappy face. She stared at me as if I was insane. Fair enough. If Major Mun is alive, and if you can help us find her, I will legitimately argue for leniency on your behalf. You don't walk, but you don't go to a black site where no one who works there ever heard of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Look into my eyes and tell me if I'm joking. Sweat beaded her upper lip. If you go a step forward and tell me everything, and I do mean every goddamn thing, about Rafael Santoro, Kuga, Harcourt, Bolton, the Fixers, and the Five Iron Men, then you might actually get out of prison while you're still young enough to enjoy your AARP benefits. Are you following me? There was the tiniest of movements of her head. Not sure if it was a twitch or a nod. I cupped my hand around my ear.
Sorry, didn't hear you.
I slapped my palm down on the table so fast and hard that she jumped and screamed. In the coldest voice I own, I said, "Be very careful what you say next. If the word lawyer plays any part of that sentence, you are going to fall into a world of shit." She started to cry. They were not weak tears. None of that girlish tears, chauvinistic bullshit. This was a strong, dangerous, capable woman. No. These tears were pure terror. Then she said the four most horrible words a person could say. They broke her. They twisted her mouth into such an ugly shape that it turned everything in my stomach to icy slush and robbed all the heat from the world. She said, "They have my daughter." Chapter 112. Aoi Otera, The Blue Temple, Interrogation Room 3, Tsushima Island, Japan. I stood up and hurried to the door, knocked to be let out, and pulled the door shut behind me. "You heard?" I asked. Bunny looked and looked through the grill.
"Fuck me," he said softly. "These pricks are lower than whale shit. We need to be cutting some throats here."
Andrea was already speaking on a wall-mounted telephone.
"He's right here," he said, and handed me the phone. "Wilson."
"Scott," I said, "what can we do? What do we have in that area? I'm almost afraid of sending in more feds because I think they've been infiltrated too, the way they took out Burke's family."
"Well, Colonel, there is someone in the area, but he's not military. He's one of Junie's Free Tech colleagues down there working on some disaster relief from the last hurricane."
I closed my eyes.
"You're going to tell me it's toys, aren't you?
Mr. Chisma is the closest capable asset available."
"Shit. Okay, do it."
Chapter 113. Cromwell Park Drive, Virginia Beach, Virginia. Alexander Chismer, toys to everyone who knew him from before his days as CEO of Freetech, leaned back against the stucco wall of the FEMA building in Virginia Beach. He closed his eyes and exhaled a long, slow, sad chest full of breath.
"Bloody fucking hell," he whispered.
He heard a crunch on the gravel.
"You okay, Mr. C?"
Toys opened his eyes. His chief of security, Maxine Rudd, loomed over him. Toys was slender and average height, but Maxine, affectionately known as Mad Max, was 6'3" of scowling muscle. She wore camo pants, a green Freetech t-shirt, and a 6-hour 9mm in a nylon shoulder holster. Her partner, Croc Peters, stood a couple of feet behind her. They both looked worried. Toys looked at them. Mad Max and Croc were ex-DMS field agents who now worked for him. Mostly they drove cars, checked security at venues, liaised with local law, and ran interference because Toys generally did not like to talk to people. Among the staff, the assignment to protect him was called Minding the Dragon. They never bothered him with chit-chat and did not question why Toys' first stop in any town was a visit to a church. Mostly Catholic, but for the boss, any church will do. They each carried cash in case he ran out and needed some for the poor box. Toys did not know how much they knew about his past, other than that he'd once been employed by the Seven Kings and had left that organization and come to work for Mr. Church as the head of Freetech. Junie Flynn was the public face and, inarguably, its heart, but Toys was the money and the useful deviousness
that sheared through red tape and political resistance. "Do you know where Cromwell Park Drive is?" asked Toys. "And how fast we can get there?"
"Sure," said Mad Max. "Finding it is nothing. How fast do we need to be there?"
Toys pushed off the wall and began walking briskly toward the helicopter parked on the landing pad out back. That was answer enough. The pilot had the rotors turning and the bird was in the air in no time. The chopper cut through the air. As they flew, Toys explained the situation. Mad Max and Croc did not waste time with foolish questions. They unfolded a laptop and brought up Google Maps, switched to satellite view, and made decisions on where to land.
"It'll be a 700-yard run," said Croc, "or I can steal someone's car."
"How fast can you do that?"
asked Toys. Croc merely laughed and began sorting through a metal case of electronic equipment. He shoved a few items into his pockets and then accepted a combat shotgun from Mad Max. The flight was 17 minutes. They put down in a parking lot of an abandoned Kmart. Before leaving the machine, Toys grabbed a clipboard and the pilot's unmarked gray ball cap. It was mundane and functional, though in any other circumstance, Toys would rather be eaten by rabid voles than wear that kind of hat. The residential area was a short block away. Mad Max and Croc split off from him, while Toys slowed to a walk and then a saunter, pretending to look from his clipboard to addresses painted on curbs, mailboxes, or homes. He knocked on the door of the house next to the target, asked directions of a sleepy old lady, smiled a big fake smile, and went to the target house. He could see no one but felt eyes on him. That was fine. He was no virgin when it came to deception and play-acting. He walked right up and knocked on the door. While he waited, he made a subtle show of studying the clipboard, idly flipping a page or two. Beyond the door, he heard a baby cry and felt only marginal relief. As he always did in moments when he was out in public, he felt the presence of his ghosts. So many of them. All of the people he either murdered, ordered, killed, or whose deaths he enabled by his association with monsters like Sebastian Galt, Hugo Vox, and the Seven Kings. Although Toys believed in the biblical promise of redemption, he did not believe that he deserved it. No matter how much good he did now through Free Tech, no matter how many people he saved with his investments, charities, and covert philanthropy, it was his unshakable belief that damnation waited for him after death. No limbo, no purgatory, no resurrection of the soul. He did not want to be redeemed and accepted hell as the natural and fitting punishment for his many sins. Jobs like this, favors for Joe Ledger or Mr. Church, might put blood on his hands, but it would not darken his soul. That was already painted a toneless black. Footsteps clicked along a tiled floor, and then the door opened a few inches, enough for a 4-inch slice of a man's face to scowl out at him. "What do you want?" demanded the man. He was some mix of Asian, mused Toys. Japanese and something else, possibly Thai. A good-looking man in his mid-30s. Toys waved the clipboard.
"Mr. Kang, I'm from the Independence Middle School. We're fundraising for Bobby Miller. Perhaps you've heard about him on the news. His parents' car was hit on the way home from practice, and they're okay, thank the Lord Jesus, but Bobby's in a coma, and the medical bills are just piling up. We're collecting donations to help defray those costs and show love and support for the Millers."
The man stared at him with dead eyes for a 3 count, and then actually dug into his pocket, peeled a $10 bill off a roll, and opened the door wide enough to hand it over.
"Sure, whatever," said the man.
Toys reached for the bill but missed it. The 10 fluttered down and the man automatically bent to catch it. Toys brought his knee up so sharply the man had no chance at all of blocking it, and his nose exploded with a wet crunch. Then Toys shoved him back, pushing his way into the living room. A woman sat on a couch holding the crying baby to her in a rough embrace. She gaped at Toys, dropped the child onto the floor as she scrambled for the Glock on the coffee table. She was very fast. She was not nearly fast enough.
Toys cleared the 9 feet between door and couch, hooked the table with a foot, and kicked it halfway across the room. The gun flew straight up in the air, he caught it, pivoted, and whipped the barrel across the woman's face as she shot to her feet. The blow slung blood and teeth on the curtains. Toys spun back to the man who'd answered the door and who was on his knees trying to pull his gun out of his waistband, but he was slipping on bloody fingers.
"Sodding amateurs," growled Toys as he took the gun away and repeated the action, this time crashing the barrel against the side of the mouth. The man went down.
He glanced at the baby, who was crying even louder now, screaming, but otherwise seemed to be okay. Croc appeared in the doorway to the kitchen, grinning the way he did when things got ugly. He had a Marine Corps K-bar in his left hand, and it was red to the crossbar.
"Two of them," he said. "Mad Max is cleaning the rest up, no noise."
"Clear the house," ordered Toys.
Croc unslung his shotgun and went up the stairs, returning in seconds, nodding that all was okay. He repeated the action with the cellar and garage. Mad Max came in, her face aglow as if they were all on holiday.
"Two watchers, one in a car, the other in an empty house across the yard. No muss, no fuss," she said, as she always did.
"Well, a little bit of muss," said Croc, right on cue.
"Can we interrogate either of the watchers?"
"With a seance, maybe."
Toys nodded to the baby.
"Do something with that."
He preferred not to touch children. Ever. Croc squatted down and picked the child up and bounced her gently. The baby began to settle at once, which pulled a surprised grunt from Toys, but then Croc brought the baby over and held her up to show her legs. There were cigarette burns on both legs and the bottoms of the tiny pink feet. Not new, weeks old, but badly healed. Two of them were infected. Toys turned away.
"Kitchen," he snapped.
Mad Max dragged the two dazed and bleeding survivors into the kitchen and tied them securely with flex cuffs. The woman was mostly conscious and glared death at the three of them. Toys wasn't fooled. He saw the fear there, too. He pulled over a plastic chair and sat on it.
"We're going to have a lovely chat," he said amiably. "You can save yourself a great deal of discomfort by not forcing us to go through the process of you pretending you're tough enough to endure what I'm willing to do. You work for Rafael Santoro, so you must know it never works."
"I knew Santoro. I've seen him in action. I know you are fixers. So be a useful little cow and just tell me everything."
"Fuck you,"
said the woman, and tried to spit on him. Her attempt fell short. Toys sighed and drew a slender knife from his inside pocket.
"Very well,"
he said wearily.
"Let's begin, shall we?"
Chapter 114 Oio Terra, The Blue Temple, Interrogation Room 4, Tsushima Island, Japan. This is how it is for us. The DMS and now RTI. There is nothing. Then there is way too much random information, like pieces from 20 different jigsaw puzzles jumbled together. Then some kind of dam bursts and the information floods in. So much that it's like getting caught in a surge when a levee breaks. I went into an empty interrogation room and sat down on a chair with my heels up. It's a trick. Putting the body into a posture of calm nonchalance sometimes tricks the mind into relaxing. Andrea was next door minding Kang and was apparently attempting to amuse her by demonstrating card tricks. Not that the woman was at all interested, but Andrea has some issues. Bunny came and leaned his big shoulder against the door frame. He was sipping some kind of blueberry Korean soda. Bug called, and I put it on the speaker. He and an Arclight agent named Annie Han had found and interviewed Ainil Tan, the woman behind the punk press video. After sifting through the bits she knew and the stuff we were learning, it was clear that a man named Adam, who was almost certainly the partner of Eve, had approached her with a hot tip. Adam had excellent bona fides from all sorts of underground whistleblower groups.
Those credentials were probably retrofitted onto the right websites, said Bug. Some pretty sophisticated work, but Annie and I will be able to take it apart.
He said Annie and I with an unusual amount of emotion.
I've uploaded an identikit picture of Adam, said Bug, and we're getting a lot of hits, maybe 14 different aliases in 24 places. Surveillance camera footage has him with a cute blonde. We figure that's Eve. Those images have been enhanced and shared with our whole network and with ArcLight. Both were last seen in South Korea, so they're here.
He explained that Adam sold Anil on a story that he was in U.S. military intelligence and caught wind of something illegal his government was doing. He could not risk blowing the whistle himself because he would go to jail or have to run like Edward Snowden. So instead he used his connections to find Punk Press and flattered Anil by saying no one else had the right blend of integrity and guts. Bug said that Anil Tan was very smart, but young and probably too optimistic. She bought the story and went to the island with Adam, both of them in hazmat suits.
Here's the thing that unplugged her from believing in this guy, said Bug. When they ran the video on the news, there was that bit of dialogue where an American sailor was talking trash about Kim Jong-un. Anil said they didn't record anything like that. I guess Santora's crew figured she would be freaked by that and sent Adam around to shut her up.
He told me how she blew up her kitchen and burned Adam. A second identikit was made with probable burn marks. Is she willing to go on record with all of this? I asked.
We finished recording a full statement half an hour ago, he said. Mr. Church has it already, and it's being shared with the four governments. We can prove Adam has never been in military intelligence or in any government job. He's a ghost, though, which is frustrating on one hand because I know you'd like to have a long talk with him, but on the other hand, it sticks a pin in the American conspiracy theory. I think, as far as war in this area goes, we can all go take a shower and get a foot rub.
Spectacular work, Bug.
Should I preen?
You should. Bug said he and Annie were going to get Anil out of the country. I suggested Phoenix House, and he said they were heading to the airport at that moment.
Hey, said Bunny dryly. We won one. What's that make it? 1-2? Yay, us.
Bug ended the call, and Toys called a few moments later.
Ledger, he said, in about the same way someone would say testicular cyst. There wasn't a lot of love between us.
Toys, I said, giving it the same inflection.
The baby?
Alive.
But?
He told me about borderline malnutrition and unchanged diaper and cigarette burns. He said that the father's body was wrapped in black plastic trash bags in a basement closet. I sat there very still and stared a burning hole through the wall. I saw a look in Bunny's eyes that was ugly and deadly, and probably a match for my own.
We took two of the four-person team, he said.
Very calmly, I said,
were you able to get anything from them?
There was a sound. Could have been a laugh or a sob. Hard to tell. Toys said,
I got everything from them.
Hold on, I said, and conferenced Scott Wilson, Doc, and Church in on the call. Okay, the gang's all here, Toys. Give us all of it. He did. The people Toys interrogated were part of a group of 100 freelancers being trained to be fixers. It was possible that 100 was only a single training group. Santoro called it a century and had made some reference to a cohort and a legion. That was significant and scary. A cohort was an old Roman designation for a group of 6 centuries, which in turn formed 1/10 of a legion. We did not believe Santoro had managed to build an army of 6,000 mercenaries. Not saying it was impossible, but it was very unlikely, given the time needed to do it and what would be required to hide, train, equip, and arm an army of that size. No, but if he had one or more cohorts, that was bad enough. Worse than bad.
The fixers said they worked for Kuga, but from what they told Toys, it seemed like Kuga was the name of the organization. If there was a person of that name, the fixers didn't know that for sure. They believed Santoro answered to someone or to a group, but that was above their pay grade. The Korea gig was some kind of client job, which seemed to verify what Nikki found out about the five Iron Men. It seemed obvious those five pricks were our collective big bad. The fixers thought that there were other operations ongoing, but they were only told about their part of the Korea op. They knew about Adam and Eve, and Toys said he detected animosity and jealousy because the blonde kids were teachers' pets to Santoro. They called him Daddy, and he called them his firstborn. They also gave us some locations, recruiting centers near four different U.S. military bases, others in South Africa, Turkey, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, South Sudan, and Thailand. One of Toys' captives was involved in recruiting before graduating to field operations. They also gave up two training facilities, one in Yemen and one near Dryden in Washington State. And that was all. It was a lot, but the fixers did not know where Santoro was. They didn't know where the Kuga headquarters were. They had no idea if there was more to the Korea thing. How sure are you about the Korea situation? I asked. Because it feels to me like there's another shoe to drop.
If there was more to give, said Toys, they would have given it.
He dropped out of the call, but I stayed on with the others. Wilson said,
We can act on all of this. If we move quickly enough, we might have a chance to cripple the Kuga network.
Do it, said Church, and Wilson was gone. After a pause, Doc said,
Well, boys, I don't know whether to shit or wind my watch here. And I'm with my honey bunny in that I can't believe this whole thing is just going to peter out into a simple mop the floors and dust the shelves thing. One minute we're about to bend over and kiss our asses goodbye, and the next minute the president of these United States and the little psychopath from North Korea are acting like they just blew each other.
How well you sum it all up, said Church.
You know what I'm saying, Deacon. If everything's coming your way, then maybe you're driving in the wrong lane.
I think we're all on the same page, admitted Church. But if there is more to this, then we are absent the proof. What we know is that Kuga attempted a big play and failed. Perhaps it is a matter of overreach. Trying to incite a war with two of the world's great superpowers is bold. The fact that it very nearly worked says a great deal about the sophistication of our enemies. And their weaknesses, I said. So it would seem. However, I believe Dr. Holliday has a quaint saying for that.
Something about counting chickens,
suggested Doc.
Now, Outlaw, as much as I like agreeing with you, take a step back and see what they accomplished. They killed hundreds of people with a brand new bioweapon. Maybe it was developed in that lab in Aleppo that you and your lovely band of cutthroats blew into orbit, but I don't believe so. I can see a lab that small being used for some kind of testing, but nothing you described speaks to something sophisticated enough for large-scale biological weapons research.
Which means the lab is still out there, I said glumly. Fuck me.
Oh, I think Junie would spank me hard if I did that.
Cute. So, if the Korean Peninsula isn't about to become a battleground, then we're talking some serious mission creep. Looking for that lab and hunting for Kuga and Santoro. Yes, said Church. That has to be high priority, though whether it is an RTI case or not remains to be seen. We have been very frank with the four governments, and they will be throwing their considerable assets into that hunt. The intel provided by Mr. Chismer is extremely useful. I will decide which agencies to share it with. Arclight will want a piece of it as well, as will Kingdom, since Major Mun was one of theirs. I can also imagine the SEALs would like an opportunity to avenge their own. So what do? Eat popcorn and watch from the sidelines? Church thought about that for a moment, and we listened to the silence. Given the possible size and reach of the Kuga organization, he said slowly, I think you should bring Havoc Team here to Oslo. You, Top, and Bunny are the only active operators who have experience with Santoro and his former Kingsman,
and you can provide useful advice to other players on our in-house teams and to our friends. What about Harcourt Bolton? Is he Kuga or not? Frankly, Colonel, I do not know. My gut says yes, but we do not have any corroboration of real substance. It's possible he is simply in hiding. It's possible he also works for Kuga without being its head. We don't know, and we will have to find out. I sighed. I'm going to interview the Kang woman, I said. I'll tell her that her kid's alive and what happened to her. Maybe she'll have something to say. I know how I'd be if someone tortured my nephew and niece. She's an actual mother, and her kid is safe. She's out from under Santora's control and might want some payback. Go talk to her, said Church. I'll see you in Oslo as soon as you clean up things there. The line went dead.
For the record, boss, said Bunny, I think this one's ending weird, too.
Chapter 115. Aoyotera, the Blue Temple, Interrogation Room 3, Tsushima Island, Japan. The three of us talked with Sun Wei Kang. When I told her that her baby was safe, she began to cry. When I told her what they'd done to her baby, she screamed. It took a while to calm her down. She jerked at the chains. She thrashed about, cutting herself, spit flying, eyes filled with madness. Andrea got up and wrapped his arms around her and held her, despite the violence, despite the attempts to bite him and headbutt him. He held her through the immediacy of that storm. Bunny and I exchanged a look. We both felt enormously embarrassed and sad. The screams, like any storm, passed. She sagged back against the chair, dripping with sweat, tears running down into her nose and mouth, shudders like earthquake aftershocks rippling through her. I got up, fished a key out of my pocket, and unlocked her chains. Andrea stepped aside, and I squatted down and took her hands in mine. She stared at me in total surprise. Sun Wei, I said gently, Santoro and Kuga and the others are still out there. Adam and Eve are still out there. If there is anything you can tell us that will help me and my team find them, then you...
I'll tell you everything I know,
she cut in. Her teeth were clenched, her lips peeled back.
As long as you promise me you'll fucking kill them all.
That, I said calmly, is the only plan I have. She told us everything. An hour's worth of unfiltered truth. She gave us better physical descriptions of Adam and Eve. She gave us the names of 9 other people at Fort Story who'd been compromised and 6 here in Japan. She gave me locations for blind drops of money and equipment. She gave us the locations of 2 safe houses. She gave us everything she had. I put it into our network. Scott Wilson assured me that people would go out to investigate all of this. People. But not us. Chapter 116. Tsushima Island, Japan. We spent a couple of days in Japan watching things happen and feeling moderately put out about the fact that we were no longer running the show. I called Church, and Wilson, and Doc about a dozen times each. Church was busy in Oslo hosting meetings with the heads of state who needed their egos massaged. Wilson was there, too, keeping those same world leaders from using the incident as proof that A, the situation in the region of the Korean Peninsula needs to radically change, or B, the situation in the region needs to remain the same. Wilson is rarely flustered, but the last time I spoke with him, he seemed ready to strangle kittens. I called Rudy about it and got a lecture about being a control freak. He did not use those words because he's too urbane and compassionate and civilized. No. He phrased it so that I didn't feel like a hurt teenager who can't get a date for the prom. His closing remark was, "The world has changed and your role in it has evolved, cowboy. Try and take comfort from the fact that there are now many organizations ready to do their share of heavy lifting." It took great effort not to tell him to go piss up a rope. After a suitable period of sulking, with plenty of good local beer to grease my cognitive wheels, I called Junie and told her what I was feeling, what Rudy said, and that I, in actual point of fact, was guilty of hubris. I was annoyed that useful, reliable, dependable old Joe Ledger wasn't the one being seen to save the world. Because Junie is immensely more mature than me, she did not give me any species of "I told you so." Instead, she told me she loved me and said that spending Christmas with Sean and the family in Maryland would do us both a lot of good. It was oddly sobering. I spent the rest of that day in a dry suit, doing nothing more useful than scuba diving off the island. Tsushima has the coldest and most northern coral reef in the world, with all kinds of newly discovered coral species. There is a warm current that brings tropical fish into the area, and they were such an unexpected delight that I felt my heart lift. There is something both otherworldly and deeply grounding about diving reefs, especially those as untouched as these. Gorgeous, tranquil, and about a million miles away from pain and bioweapons, from tortured babies and slaughtered families. Somewhere down in the blue-green waters, I felt something change inside my heart and head. Yeah, maybe I was guilty of thinking I was the one permanently on deck to save the world, and yeah, I could see now that this was far from the truth. I knew that now, even after all of my victories with the DMS and RTI, I was still trying to redeem my soul for being unable to save Helen. Among the coral and fishes, I found a measure of perspective on that and a grudging acceptance that those terrible events long ago were not my failure, but simply beyond my control. I could not have saved her. Wanting to did not change that. Trying to be the champion of the world wouldn't change it either. I thought about the unknown woman on the Island of Frogs, the one I'd made a mental promise to. I could not save her, either, even if I caught and killed every single person who was part of the Kuga machine. She was still going to be dead. I was not a demigod capable of restoring life to the unjustly slain. I swam beneath the waves and tried to release the strictures of my pride that held on to the things I could never control. A few brightly colored fish of a kind I did not know and couldn't name swam with me for a time, and one by one peeled away as if taking fragments of my darkness with them. I would tell Rudy about this. I would tell Junie. But not yet. Instead, I swam and swam and was, in some small way, healed. Chapter 117. Diver's Bathhouse, Tsushima Island, Japan. They tried to take me, quick and quiet. I was naked as an egg, covered in soap and shampoo, alone in the shower stall. My dry suit was on a bench and my tanks hung on a peg. The spray masked the sound of them entering, but I felt a cool breeze and turned to see shapes rushing me, three of them. Not big, but big enough. Dressed in black, moving fast, there was a flash of steel, knives, black-bladed commando-style field knives. You don't use them to go hunting unless you're hunting men. Fixers. Had to be. The lead guy slashed low and hard, trying to gut me. I twisted out of the way and felt the cloth of his sleeve brush my hip instead of the cold point of the knife. I turned the twist into a spin and chopped him in the back of the neck with my elbow, real damn hard. He staggered forward and I heard him hit the wall, but I was going straight after the other two. They were fast and they had the advantage, but they did not know how to fight together. Most people don't, not even most killers. They both tried to slash at me at the same time, both trying to disembowel. If they'd thought it through and went high and low, They'd have had me. Maybe. I slid to my left and chopped the closest arm, and then shoulder-checked him so that he stumbled into his buddy. They were wearing sneakers, but not the right kind for a soapy, tiled floor. They both slid, and I helped them along by hitting the guy I had just checked with four very fast, very hard palm shots to the ear. He screamed as his eardrum burst. I slapped my hand down against the wrist of his extended arm, pinning it against my wet thigh, and then used both hands to take the knife away from him. Now it was two armed thugs, one unarmed and injured thug, and me with a knife. Bare-ass naked, sure, but with a knife. That is much better math. For me. For them, the math sucked ass. They gave it a good try, though, pushing off the wall, coming at me again, trying to spread out and circle me. If I was an idiot, I'd have backed away and been killed, or charged them and been killed. Instead, I faked left and went right, sliding across the floor to engage the first man. He tried a throat cut this time, but I ducked under it and sliced the outside of his lead knee. The knife was excellent and honed to razor sharpness, and it cut through the hamstring tendon with shocking ease. He screamed and went down onto that same knee while I checked my cut, reversed, and took him in the right eye with the point. Not deep. I didn't want to lose the knife to suction. I shoved him toward the others, but the soap on the floor made me slide backward, and for a moment I pinwheeled for balance. Then I dropped into a squat like a surfer on a wild board, reclaimed my balance, and dodged left to get to the outside of the two men coming at me. The one whose eardrum I burst dove down to try and take the knife from his crippled friend, but I chopped down with the butt of my knife, and the extra force slammed him belly and chin first onto the unforgiving tiles. I stepped on him and over and slashed at the thrusting arm of the third man, catching it with a shallow slice across the forearm and then crashing into his side with my shoulder and chest. We crashed back and fell. Since I knew that was the likely result of our impact, I rode the fall and used the confusion to half-roll onto his knife arm, pinning it between us. He dropped the knife, and damn if he didn't reach down and grab me by the balls. He grabbed real damn hard, and the pain sent 10 million bolts of white-hot agony up through my stomach and into my heart. I screamed. I did not stop fighting to scream, though. Idiots do that. I used the pain to kick me into aggressive overdrive. I headbutted him, elbowed him across the temple, bit his nose, and when I could get my hand into position, I cut his damn throat. He gurgled and collapsed back, vomiting blood and thrashing wildly. His fucking hand was still locked on my scrotum, and I had to cut his wrist tendons to free myself. I rolled off him, sick and dizzy, in time to see the guy with the burst eardrum come up off the ground. His chin was split and blood ran over his lower lip, but his face was twisted into a mask of hatred. He dove at me before I could get away, and we fell back hard, rolling all the way to the edge of the shower. He was about 20 pounds lighter than me, but he knew how to wrestle. He knew a lot of dirty tricks, and he tried them all. Twisting joints, sticking his thumb in the hollow of my throat, headlocks, an arm lock that would have shattered my elbow if I hadn't locked my frame, twisted my hips, and bit his calf. Yeah, I know a lot of guys dig that MMA bullshit. Those supposedly unbreakable holds, the floor pins, the mounts. Oh, please. If you're in a ring with rules, with a ref, and you can tap out, then sure, it can be pretty intense. But even cage fights have rules. I, on the other hand, am not a sportsman. Never was. I tore a chunk out of his calf, then pivoted more and bit his balls. Weird? Sure. Nasty? Sure. Worked, though. His scream hit the ultrasonic and he lost the integrity of his lock. I took my arm back and then spent the next 10 seconds breaking everything of his that I could break while still leaving him alive. One of his buddies was dead, the other was in shock with a pierced eye and blood loss and was maybe half in a coffin. This asshole still had a pulse and I really, really wanted to have a meaningful chat. When I finished, he wasn't going anywhere. He lay there, quivering, too hurt to do anything but whimper. I crawled to the wall and used it to climb up, wheezing, gasping, my nuts on fire, my nerves shot to shit. My gear bag was on a bench outside, and I grabbed my gun, crept to the exit door, and looked out. No one in sight. I went back and looked down at the three men. They were total strangers. The guy with the pierced eye looked Korean. The dead one was maybe Italian or some kind of swarthy Mediterranean. My wrestling partner was Caucasian. None of them were Santoro or Adam. The injured man looked up at me with terrified, pain-filled eyes. He looked into my eyes and saw something there. Maybe it was like looking into a magic mirror that showed him what the next few minutes of his life were going to be like.
"Please," he begged.
I smiled.
"No,"
I said. Chapter 118. Aboard the Soul of Piety, Kiel Canal, River Elbe, Germany. Santoro set down his phone and looked up at the ceiling.
"Did they get him?" asked Kuga, who was alert and impatient. "Is the son of a bitch dead?"
"No,"
said the Spaniard.
"How many guys did you send?"
"3. Good men, excellent fighters."
"You told me it would be a simple cleanup operation."
"It should have been."
They sat staring at nothing for a long time, each chewing on the bitter reality of it.
"Next time, why don't you just throw some grenades at him? Ledger's a maniac, but he's one of the most dangerous people I ever heard of. Blow the fucker up next time."
Santoro gave him a thin smile and said nothing. Chapter 119. Oi Oterra, the Blue Temple, the Orb, Tsushima Island, Japan. "They were a cleanup crew," I said. "At least that's what my shower buddy told me. I am convinced it's what he believes." Church's hologram sat there taking small bites out of a vanilla wafer. Doc stood on one side of him and Wilson on the other as if they were all in the same room, but Church was in Oslo and they were still in Greece.
"Did he give a list of other potential targets?" asked Church.
"A few. Colonel Epps, the rest of Havoc Team," which, by the way, he called Echo Team, so we know that Kuga's network doesn't have ears inside RTI.
"Thank God for small mercies," said Wilson.
Church nodded. "Anything else?"
"He corroborated some of what the fixer, Toys, questioned, told us. A few new targets, and I've uploaded them to the TOC mainframe."
Doc Holliday was grinning fit to bust.
"And all of this while you were buck naked?"
"Yes. Sorry I didn't take pictures."
"Boy, howdy, me too."
"We have some news to share, Colonel," said Wilson. "Doc, if you would start us off."
"Sure, sweetie. So, we sourced all of the parts in that drone, and yes, the computer systems were manufactured in China, but one of the key designers at the tech firm in question is Lee Hong."
"Hong," I mused. "As in the Hong family who are tied to the Five Iron Men?"
"Nephew once removed," she said. "That's one thing. The next is some digging I had Nikki do about Syria. Even though the lab is all blown up, the equipment had to come from somewhere. Mind reader Q1 just busybodied its way into Mr. Assad's government computers, and in two shakes of a sheep's tail, we have all kinds of purchase orders and shipping manifests. Now, I just bet you can guess where they bought their parts."
"The Hongs?"
"Yippers. From companies and very shady private firms in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and all over North Korea. And some off-market stuff from sources unnamed, so we can assume that's black market. And black market means..."
"Kuga," I said.
"You go straight to the top of the class,"
Church said. "I briefed the four heads of state about this an hour ago. Arrest warrants have been issued for 19 members of the immediate Hong family and 54 others tied to their businesses. As to the Five Iron Men, 3 are in custody and 2 committed suicide." I sat down on a chair.
"Well,
kiss my ass," I said,
and smiled while I said it. "Come to Oslo," said Church as he brushed cookie crumbs from his tie. "The turfisk is delicious." Oslo, Norway. Part 6. An eye for an eye will only make the whole world blind. Mahatma Gandhi. Chapter 120. In Darkness. The woman woke in darkness. Bound, bleeding, bruised over every inch of her body that she could feel. She lay there, feeling the damage, listening for any sounds, fighting for a sense of where she was. The pain in her head was so ferocious it crowded everything else out. Almost. She felt movement before she heard sound. It made no sense to her. The floor on which she lay was moving, tilting back and forth very slowly, but very steadily. She strained to make sense of it, but the darkness around her seemed to flood into her mind, and she was gone. For a while. There was no way to know how long she was out. Minutes? Hours? She did not think it was much longer than that because the level of pain was about the same. Cuts hurt less over time. Deep bruises got worse. She ran a tongue around the inside of her mouth and discovered that several important teeth were missing. The gums hurt worse than any other part of her. That was when a small door of memory opened for her. The teeth. She remembered losing them. No, that wasn't right, and she forced her mind to be precise. She remembered them being taken from her, torn out, rocked back and forth in their sockets with pliers, and then pulled from the roots. She remembered the taste of her own blood. She remembered the screams that had tried to claw their way up from her lungs and out through her mouth. She remembered fighting them down, refusing them, refusing to gift her torturers with those screams. Not with the lost teeth. Not with the small cuts on her nipples and between her toes. Not even when they ground the lit cigarette into her cheeks. She had not screamed once. Now, here, in the fetid darkness, she wanted to let the screams out. She did not. The floor moved, and a sound, muffled and odd, snuck through walls to whisper in her ear. A slapping sound, soft, unemphatic. Water.
"I'm on a boat,"
she thought, and knew it to be true. But whose boat? Did that Spanish bastard, the monster, have a boat? Why had he brought her to it? Why was she even still alive? She lay there, testing her bonds, assessing the damage, inventorying her strengths, planning her escape, planning her revenge. Chapter 121. D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Sonja Hennie's Plus 3, Oslo, Norway. The place looked like a miniature version of the United Nations. Flags everywhere, and not just those of the 9 nuclear nations. Other countries were in attendance as well. Some as allies of the denuclearization process, some because they had nuclear energy programs and their centrifuges and waste would be topics of discussion. 31 countries in all. Every hotel in Oslo was crammed with dignitaries, the press, anti-nuke protesters, more press, government officials, and, yeah, more press. Havoc Team was there as event security, meaning we were supposed to be in the employ of the Norwegian government. That was some of the combined sorcery of Scott Wilson and Mr. Church. They made quite a formidable team. We were dressed in standard, upper-level security clothes, black suits, white shirts, dark ties, wires behind our ears. We were armed, but with Snellig dart pistols loaded with Sandman. The conference was scheduled for the big convention room at the Blue Plaza, which is also where all of the heads of state and their entourages were booked. They filled the entire 678 rooms, with some of those suites set aside for ops centers, security team staging, very select ticketed press, and a few high-profile guests. You had to know God personally and be able to show vacation selfies with him to get into that place. Even Top, who was notorious for his disdain of most security setups, kept grunting his approval.
"You sound like a boss hog, old man," complained Bunny. "Grunt, grunt, grunt."
Top gave him 2 seconds of a withering look.
"You know, farm boy, it is actually possible to kick a 2x4 up someone's ass if you try real hard."
Andrea snorted and offered a fist to Belle for a bump. She stared at it, shrugged, and bumped. We walked the crowded halls on the conference level. It seemed like every third person we saw wore the same kind of clothes we did. They gave us the same uninformative stares we gave them. They teach that at tough guy school.
"Scusa me, Colonello,"
said Andrea quietly as we rounded a corner and walked past an ornate stairwell that looked like a piece of art.
"But do we actually have an assignment?"
"Not as such, no," I said. "We are vagabond thugs." Bunny said,
"Not sure I've ever seen this much security."
"You complaining?" asked Top.
"Not even a little. Even my virtue feels protected."
Top grunted.
"You think this is security?" said Andrea. "You should see how they guard the Pope's porn collection." "If something happens," said Belle, pointedly ignoring Andrea's comment, "what actions do we take? Who owns the trigger pull?"
I snorted. "Scott Wilson has been pulling his hair out all night trying to figure that out. Short answer is, we are, at best, support. The badges we have are legit, but each world leader has his or her own people, and we do not want to get between them and any bad guys. I don't want us to be the collateral damage on somebody's after-action report."
"Hurrah," said Top.
"Who fucking are?" said Bunny.
"Colonel Letcher."
I turned to see a thin man hurrying toward me, one of the many Norwegian officials who was there to massage overblown political egos and keep things chugging along. I fished for his name and pulled it out of my ass.
"Mr. Muller," I said, "what can I do for you?"
He leaned close and lowered his voice.
"Colonel, I've been asked to escort you to a small private reception."
"Now? Isn't the conference starting soon?"
"This, will not take long, and I believe you will find it rather interesting."
Muller had a soft, high-pitched voice that for some reason reminded me of how a ferret might talk.
"Your associates are free to wait here or continue patrolling. Now, sir, if you please."
I gave Top a nod and followed Muller through a guarded doorway and through a series of service hallways to another door that was even more heavily guarded. My ID was checked and my retina scanned, and then Muller ushered me into a small conference room crammed with a dozen people. Security, translators, Scott Wilson, Mr. Church, and the four heads of state for China, North and South Korea, and the United States. They all looked up as I entered. It was one of the strangest moments of my life. The President of the People's Republic of China was closest to me and came over to offer his hand. His translator came with him, but the President spoke in very good English.
"Colonel Ledger,"
he said,
"I will be frank. Your name is well known in certain circles within my government."
I said, "Okay." His dark eyes searched mine, and he wore an enigmatic half-smile.
"There have been quite a few times when my countrymen had cause to curse your name. There are many of my generals who wanted to make a special project out of you."
He gave the words an emphasis that left no doubts as to their meaning. I'm okay with that, Mr. President. Send them along. He shook his head.
No, he said, not today. In fact, I hope that you can understand and appreciate what I am about to say. As of this moment, all past transgressions are forgiven. If your name is on any list, it will be taken off. In this moment, and unless your future actions require it, you are no longer an enemy of the People's Republic of China.
That's nice to know, but here's the thing. I don't have a beef with China. Actually, I don't have a beef with anyone. I do, however, have a beef with anyone who tries some big play to do a lot of harm to innocent people. As long as your people don't do something that forces me and mine to come hunting, then we'll get along fine. I'm not going to turn a blind eye, though. Not for you and not for anyone in this room. Or any country anywhere. I'm not political. I'm a shooter. Guys like me react when someone else starts a fight. As of right now, sir, I have no one in China on my list. However, if future actions require it, they'll hear from me in ways they won't like. His smile flickered, then firmed up.
Then we understand each other, Colonel.
I hope we do, Mr. President. He offered his hand again, and we shook. After that, the President of South Korea thanked me and clutched my hand like someone who'd been saved from drowning. He shook my hand, held on, and leaned close.
If you ever need a friend in my country, Colonel, you reach out to me personally.
When he released my hand, I could feel the stiffness of a folded piece of paper against my palm. I quietly slipped it into my pocket. The next two meetings were surreal. Kim Jong-un was a short, round, young man who spoke with great diction and clarity via a translator, though I could understand him quite well. He made a mini-speech that, to my surprise, steered clear of political rhetoric. Instead, he vilified the Five Iron Men, the Kugo organization, and lamented the unfortunate death of the Frog Island villagers. He did not mention Colonel Ho, however, which kind of pissed me off. Kim was, by all accounts, a psychotic dictator, and yet, when I looked in his eyes, I saw a great deal of fear, as if he was trapped in the role he played. For about a second, I felt a tendency to buy it, and to carve off a slice of sympathy, but I couldn't manage it. I'd read too many reports about the inhuman conditions in North Korea, the murders and disappearances, the starvation of people, and more. No, he did not get a pass. I shook his hand because Mr. Church was watching and gave me a tiny nod, but I didn't like it. When I turned away, I wiped my hand on my trouser leg. And that left me with the President of the United States. As I'd told the Chinese president, I was not political. I'm neither left nor right. I'm an idealist and a humanist, but if all politicians suddenly vanished into thin air, I would shed damn few tears. I did not like this president and wasn't a huge fan of any of his predecessors. However, there was bad blood between us because his policies and stubbornness helped the Russians do a great deal of harm to us during the Deep Silence case. It doesn't matter one bit that he later claimed that his intelligence people did not properly warn him of the dangers. The captain of a ship is the one who takes the blame. Any ship, anywhere. All that said, he offered me a very gracious and effusive thank you, and when he was done talking, I shook his hand too. Have I mentioned lately that it's a weird goddamned world? Church walked me out. In the hallway, we stood out of earshot of any of the guards.
That looked like it hurt, he said. Not sure I'd piss on any of them if they were on fire. You have no future at all in politics, Colonel.
I grinned.
Well, thank God for that.
Chapter 122 In Darkness. They had tied her well, but not well enough. She vaguely remembered someone else in the room with the Spaniard, a beefy man who looked like a thug straight from central casting, a smiling mouth and soulless eyes. She was sure he'd been the one who tied her up. She could remember his hands on her bloody breasts, groping between her thighs. Had the Spaniard snapped at him for that, rebuked him? There was a fragment of that in her recollection, though it seemed strange. As if torture was okay as long as there was a point to it, but random sexual abuse was not. The thug had said,
"Why are we bothering with her at all, boss? She's chum for the sharks, right?"
"Not yet," replied the Spaniard.
"You think she's going to stop acting like a bitch and talk to us?"
"Everyone talks eventually."
There was a small, terrible pause before he repeated one word.
"Everyone."
They cut her loose from the chair and she tried to fight, but did not know if she did any damage. She had no memory of what happened. Instead, there was a huge furnace of pain on the back of her head. Memory, like consciousness, had been bludgeoned out of her. The thug had tied her well. He had not done it expertly, though. He'd tied her the way people do when they think the other person is helpless, as if the victim has no nerve, no imagination. In the darkness, the woman smiled. She worked her wrists against the bonds, letting the rope cut her, making fists and flexing her muscles to make herself bleed. Blood was useful. Blood, after all, was liquid, thick and viscous, and in its way, an excellent lubricant. In her darkness, she smiled as she worked. Chapter 123. D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. Havoc team had split up and was wandering the halls. Top and Bell were one level up, and Bunny and Andrea were on the ground floor. When I checked in, I found, to my great relief, that everyone was bored because no damn thing was happening, which is exactly what you want to happen. Of course, it wasn't surprising. The security here was on par with the other big summits like G8. Lots of thugs like me in suits, lots of undercover operators, lots of uniformed types. Over the loudspeaker, they began calling people to the big exhibit room where the opening remarks and introductions for the summit would take place. Masses of people began moving towards stairs, escalators, and elevators. I told Bunny I was coming down to the lobby to begin an upward floor-by-floor sweep when I saw someone on the far side of the big central stairwell. A woman dressed in the coveralls of hotel maintenance staff and carrying a small toolbox. Slim, pretty, young, and blonde. I stopped and stared at her. She seemed to turn away as soon as I looked in her direction.
"No fucking way,"
I breathed. Then I was moving, going the opposite way of the crowd, fighting to swim upstream through hundreds of people. Was it her? I couldn't be sure at all. It was only a glimpse. How could Eve even be here? Why would she be here? With all this security, how was it even possible? My uncertainty tore what I thought I'd seen to shreds. Doubt kept me from yelling, from calling it in to the house authorities. Instead, I tapped my comms unit. "Outlaw to Havoc, I'm on the mezzanine level, possible sighting of target Eve." I gave them a quick description of the woman I'd seen. Because of the density of the intervening crowd, the tiny camera on my lapel got nothing. Belle asked,
"What is the confidence in the target?"
That was a good question. 50%, I admitted. Maybe less. "Look anyway." I got a chorus of hoo-ahs, but as the seconds ticked by and gathered into minutes, none of them saw a damn thing. Great. Now we can add paranoia to being arrogant. And crazy. I was batting 1,000. Chapter 124. In darkness. She tried for hours. How many hours was impossible to know? 2? 3? The thin ropes sawed at her, tore at her, filling the black room with blood smell, with fear smell and anger. There was every chance someone would come before she worked loose. There was a very good chance her attempt to slip out would fail. But there was no chance she would give up. She lay there, in pain and darkness, curled in a pool of blood and her own urine, her breath rubbing like hot sandpaper in her throat. She did not curse or complain, even to herself. That was not who she was, because none of that would contribute one iota to getting free. All it would do would be to admit defeat. She never admitted or even accepted defeat, even now. She worked and worked. Suddenly the rope slipped halfway down her hand over the bloody bulge of her thumb, and Major Mun Ji Woo was free. Chapter 125 D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. Nobody saw a thing. I didn't, even though I went down all of the halls and peered into suites and conference rooms and closets. There was no trace of the slim blonde. Until there was. Suddenly she was there, 30 feet from me. She had her toolbox and came out of a hall, walking in my direction. As she approached, she reached into a loose pocket and began pulling something out. I could have shot her. I could have made a scene, flashed a badge, started a panic. 30 feet was a forever distance if it was a gun. I ran at her. No shouting, no waving my own pistol. I reached her in 9 very long strides and was suddenly up in her face, my hand clamping onto the wrist. "Don't," I said. The woman yelped from the pain of my grab, flinching back, but I held her and shifted to use my bulk to block what was happening from the crowds, who now stood watching the opening ceremonies on big-screen TVs mounted on all the walls.
"What are you doing?"
she cried in Norwegian. The door behind her opened and 5 other maintenance people came out, each carrying an identical toolbox. 4 men and a brunette woman, all young. They saw the woman in my grip and they stopped and frowned. I looked like security and they suddenly looked confused and scared.
"What's going on?"
asked the oldest of the men. He was maybe 30 and had pockmarked cheeks.
"What is this?"
I ignored him. To the blonde, I said, "Take it out using 2 fingers." She blinked and then gingerly removed a cell phone clutched between thumb and forefinger. It was vibrating. I took it from her and glanced at the screen display. It said, "Mom." I released her and stepped back, holding onto the phone. My lapel cam was now feeding her face to mind reader, and almost at once I heard Bug's voice in my ear.
"Outlaw, be advised, that is not Eve. Detainee is Hilda Wintersein. I have her whole history right here. School ID, driver's license, hotel security clearance. It's close, but it's not her."
"I need to see IDs," I said, also in Norwegian, pitching it with an edge of command to make them think I was more important than I am. It worked. They all produced picture IDs. Bug verified all of them. The man, who turned out to be the supervisor, said that they were told to report to the press room to fix a speaker issue. I called that in, got verification, and then let them go. I felt more annoyed than foolish, though it is always better to check than not. I saw more maintenance people, another 2 men, one with a brown buzz cut and the other with a lumberjack beard and wire-frame glasses, a chunky, black-haired woman, and a redhead, hurry in the same direction. All 4 of them glanced at me, or at least in my direction, but they seemed to be casual glances. I saw them glance at other people, too. They were too far away for me to stop, and I did not see the point. My spider sense was still tingling, but now everything wanted to trigger it. "Outlaw to Havoc," I said when I stepped into a quiet corner. "Situation negative. Continue foot patrols. Stay sharp." On the TV monitors, the Prime Minister of Norway was making a speech and smiling as if the world was a big happy place. I hoped like hell she was right. Chapter 126 In Darkness. Major Mun lost no time. Once free of her bonds, she felt around the room in which she'd been held and discovered stacks of folded material. It was sticky and smelled of salt, and that told her she was in a sail locker aboard a large boat. The patty cake slaps against the hull and the relative stability of the floor suggested the boat was moored, possibly at a dock. She pressed her ear to the wall and heard sounds, the natural creaks of a watercraft, a faintness of conversation that was strangely muted. TV, or perhaps a radio. There was no door handle inside the locker, but she traced the outline of the door itself, found the hinges. That was good. Hatches of this kind had doors that opened out. Mun had decisions to make. On one hand, she was stiff, sore, weak, and injured. On the other hand, if the boat was moored, there was a better chance of escape than if she waited and the thing set sail. No, the smart risk was to make a break for it now. Before that, though, she felt her way through the room again, looking for some kind of weapon. The sails were too big, and the nylon rope threaded through the grommets too sturdy and long to be of practical use. So she scooped up the bonds they'd used on her. By untying the knots, Mun found that she had 2 6-foot lengths of medium-strength nylon rope that was soft and flexible. She smiled, because she could do a lot of damage with that. She wore only her underwear, functional panties. Mun coiled the rope around her waist and tucked the ends into the waistband of the pants. Then she groped her way back to the door. Her head hurt horribly, and in a way that suggested she probably had a concussion. That would mean once she was through the door there would be disorientation and light sensitivity, maybe dizziness and more of the nausea that was a constant. Those things were factors to be weighed, but she did not accept them as limitations. What was required was to adjust her expectations of her physical skills and then use what she had. Mun was a practical woman, and she'd been injured before while on missions with Kingdom. The door, when she pressed against it, felt pretty tight, which meant it was a good locker that had been well installed. The actual panel of the door was a piece of particle board built into a pine frame. The panels were thin because interior lockers don't need to be strong. Mun gave it a few experimental pushes with the flats of her hands. There was give in the center. Good. She dragged the stacks of sails over and made a thick and very heavy backrest, then leaned against it, braced her hands on the wall and deck of the locker, raised her right foot, took a breath, and then exhaled as she kicked. The door held. She kicked again. A third time. On the fourth kick, the center panel of the door did not break. It simply popped out of the frame and fell flat. Weak light splashed into the locker, but Mun had a hand up to shield her eyes. She took just a moment to allow her eyes to adjust, and then she crawled out. The door was small, but so was she. Mun found herself in a long, narrow corridor of what had to be a very large craft, probably a motor sailor, private. There was no whiff of military about it. She could smell a faintness of bilge water and also coffee. She tensed, straining to hear for anyone coming to investigate the sounds she'd made. There was nothing, no yells, no footsteps. Mun got slowly to her feet, fingertips touching the walls to steady herself as she assessed balance and dizziness. The deck wobbled and the corridor took a few lazy half-turns, but then her head settled down. She removed one length of the rope, tied a thick knot on one end, and wrapped the other end around her hand and wrist. One experimental flick produced a nasty whip crack, not loud, but with vicious force. Thus armed, and smiling the coldest smile she owned, Major Mun went hunting. Chapter 127 D-9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. I found Top and Bell on the floor where the big show was unfolding. Top has the ability to look like just another guy when he wants. It's a shift of body language and a pulling in of his considerable personal power. He manages to look shorter, less muscular, and far less alert than he actually is. Belle, on the other hand, looked like a very hungry panther. People tended to walk around her rather than expecting her to get out of their way. And, to my amusement, I saw the top was using that as a distraction. He walked a dozen paces to her left, and as people passed to one side of her, he got to see them while they were distracted. I indicated a quiet spot near some potted ferns, and we drifted over. Just some folks taking a moment on a busy day. Anything? I asked.
Negative, outlaw, not a goddamn thing.
Belle shook her head. I'd gotten the same report from Andrea and Bunny.
Hate to say it, said Top, but I think we are pretty much fifth wheels here.
I nodded. We stood. The speeches droned. Time burned itself away.
Off the record, said Top. You invited me to Christmas, and I said I couldn't. Well, I can. My thing fell through.
He had a daughter in Georgia, but they were estranged. She'd lost her legs in combat, and his being an active operator seemed to trigger episodes of PTSD for her. She was the only blood kin Top had, and it had to hurt him, especially this time of year. I can't promise there won't be deeply ugly holiday sweaters and corny Christmas movies. The kids are addicted. He smiled, even though I saw some pain in his eyes.
Long as I'm not an inconvenience.
Believe me, I'm going to need some grown-ups to talk to, and Junie would cry if you weren't there. Top nodded, pleased. I knew better than to ask Belle. She'd volunteered to be duty officer at the TOC. Christmas was not her thing. The Prime Minister was about to begin introductions of the world leaders, each of whom would make a short, prepared speech. Then there would be a reading of the denuclearization proposal, followed by a break, and then breakout sessions to wrangle over finer points of negotiation. I kept looking for blonde heads. Yeah, in Norway, like looking for sand in the Sahara. Bug, I said, go through the security cameras again, run everyone's face through the software. There are a lot of people there, outlaw. Cry me a river, I told him.
Chapter 128 In Darkness. Major Munn ghosted along through the hold and up the companion ladders. She checked staterooms and closets, finding no one. She did, however, find a cupboard with a stack of extra life jackets, each of which was stenciled with a name. The Soul of Piety, and a port of registry of Vancouver. Was she in Canada? Or still in Korea? Her memory was faulty from the blow she'd received. Traumatic amnesia. Munn was sure she lost time, but how much? When she'd awakened, her body had been very sore, but as if she'd slept for a long time. Something occurred to her, and she checked her arms and thigh, and there it was. A pinprick inside her left elbow. A needle mark. They'd not only beaten her, they'd drugged her. For how long? And where was she? A voice called out, startling her, and Munn whipped around, ready to strike. But no one was there.
"Going to get my smokes," said the voice, and she realized that the acoustics bounced the sound to her, but the speaker was still in the corridor.
She heard him coming closer, the footsteps quick but heavy. Munn faded to one side of the open doorway, slipping behind a yellow rain slicker hung on a peg. A man entered the room, big, 6 feet tall, broad-shouldered, very fit-looking. He wore khakis, a t-shirt, and a weapon belt with a holstered pistol and sheathed fighting knife. He passed by her and went straight to a duffel bag on the floor below the porthole. He bent over to unzip it, and Munn made her move. She brought the heavy knot overhand and down as fast and hard as she could and hit on the base of the skull. The rope was not a killing weapon, but Munn knew how and where to hit. The sudden shock of the blow drove the man to his knees, and then Munn was moving. She looped the slack of the rope over his head, stamped one foot between his shoulder blades, and pulled with every ounce of desperate strength and speed. The 110 pounds of body weight would not have mattered much in a stand-up test of strength, but it was a lot of dead weight to suddenly jerk the slack of a nylon rope against a windpipe. She heard the hyoid bone crack like a wet eggshell. The man flopped down, clawing at his throat, turning a hideous purple, as he tried to drag air past an impenetrable obstruction. Munn darted forward and whipped the knife from its sheath, jerked the dying man's head back, and cut his throat. She let him drop so that his body blocked the spray of blood. Munn wasted no time. The gun belt was too big to bother with, so she tied the rope around her waist, snugged the knife between it and her hip, took the pistol and a spare magazine, and left. The hall was empty. She ran, barefoot, in the direction the dead man had come. There was a TV on somewhere, and Munn heard the measured tones of someone giving a speech. At the end of the hall were three steps up to a lounge. Two men sat on a big couch watching someone in a suit talking from a podium. There was no one else in sight, and the men were relaxed. She shot them both in the head from 6 feet. Then she found cover and waited for someone to come and investigate the noise. No one came. Munn searched the entire ship and found no one. The craft was anchored about 300 yards from the shore of a broad river. It was bright daylight. Back in the lounge, she began scrambling through papers, looking for some answer to where she was. She found a wrench and smashed open a locked side room, and in there, she found something that took her breath away. The room had a work table on which were laptops, a high-end graphics printer, other devices used for affixing holograms to plastic to attach security chips, and a laminator, and a whole pile of security badges, duplicates, discarded failures, and some that looked ready to use. On the upper left of each card, faded to be a background graphic, was a letter and a number. D9. Munn stared at the badges as she felt her ice turn to snowmelt. Then she raced off to find the radio or a phone to call this into Kingdom, to warn everyone of what was about to happen. Chapter 129. D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. Bug got back to me while a third of the nine world leaders was nattering on about international brotherhood.